Welcome back to the Radio Cafe. I am so honored today to have with us David Marish. He's a renowned television journalist, formerly of ABC News and Nightline. In early 2006, in a much talked about move, Marish joined Al Jazeera English and became kind of its American face. He left Al Jazeera 2 years later, citing a lack of editorial control. Marish has since moved to New Mexico, where he continues to blog on everything from politics to journalism, spying, and corporate ethics. Welcome to the Radio Cafe, David.
Thanks very much, Lily. It's a pleasure to be here, especially since I don't have to go out in the heavily falling snow.
Well, this is the joy and fun of live radio, I tell you that much.
Yep, nothing better.
Well, I'm really excited to have someone like you who knows so much about kind of the history of journalism. We're heading into 2014, and I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the changing face of journalism. You've observed news and trends since you started reporting, I think, in the early 80s. So can you talk to us a little bit about the trends that you've seen in journalism and where you see the entire field heading?
Well, I think the two sort of big structural changes are that video content is quickly superseding textual content, and that the internet and mobile platforms are superseding the traditional old media, sorry to say it, radio and especially TV.
Well, tell me a little bit about video, because I know you and I have had these discussions before, and the importance of it, because I think that there's so much video out there, people get very overwhelmed. Can you talk about how people can process that?
Well, you know, this is something that we're still learning and still learning about, but what is obvious is that more and more people around the world, probably even more dramatically outside the United States than inside the United States, are getting their news and information on video, with pictures, that is to say, and with sometimes text or voiceover illuminating the video, but really the pictures dominate the text.
Well, and that's a very sad reality that I've learned in my career working with photographers. You break your back to really kind of craft a story, and the photo takes it away, doesn't it?
Well, it doesn't so much take it away as change it. There are things, I mean, you know, the famous credo of a picture being worth 10,000 words. For some things and for some kinds of real and important information, video is better than text because you can see it and you can really process directly more and more what is going on. As almost all the world now carries cell phones that have both still and video picture components to them, it means that, almost every event is going to be covered by so-called amateurs at least faster, if not better, than the professionals. But it means that it's going to be covered visually rather than textually. And, of course, in some ways, this is very good in that it eliminates the language barrier, that you see pictures in whatever language you speak. And if the pictures are being shot by somebody who speaks Chinese or Hungarian, the fact that you only speak English is no bar, and vice versa. And so it means that all of the events of the world are likely to make it in some form of video onto the internet where they can be perceived by people all over the world. I think one of the things that stayed President Obama's hand in Syria, for example, was the perception, and I think a very correct and valuable one, that if America unleashed military force in Syria, an audience of literally billions all around the world would watch it. And to them, the distinctions between Syria and Iraq or Syria and Afghanistan would look very small, whereas the similarities would look very great, and their perception would be geared towards what they're seeing, what it looks like, so that this audience was likely to be very hostile to the idea of American military force being used beyond its borders again, and especially being used where the casualties are Muslims again. And I think that when Obama really registered that he was going to put on a show, and I don't mean to demean anything by calling warfare a show, but in terms of its video replication, in terms of how people around the world see and understand it, the show would look much too familiar to an audience that's already becoming alienated from it. And so I think he was more and more loath to resort to military force because he could understand that globally it was going to get bad reviews. The other thing is that we, I think, digest what we see through video differently from what we read in text. Again, it's sort of like the old joke of who you going to believe, me or your lying eyes. And we all instinctively believe our lying eyes. And so we see something on video, and we sort of feel like we are direct viewers of it rather than indirect viewers, and therefore we feel much freer to draw conclusions and make judgments because this is something we've seen unprocessed on our own rather than reading something which has already been interpreted by a reporter or editors or various intervenors between the unseen event and the audience for the event. And so I think that people's judgments of the news that they see via video tend to be harder, more partisan, if you will, or more particular and independent than what they get from text. And this makes them much more resistant to what they see as manipulation. Now, of course, the other side of the coin and what makes video news so dangerous is that it is even more manipulable than text, and its manipulations are less transparent than in well-reported, well-written text. And so through Photoshop or through selective shooting or through the very camera angle or point of view from which video is shot, the event is being pre-shaped for the audience before the audience, in its own mind, sees it as if it were looking out its own living room window.
Well, I was going to say that it really can be manipulated according to what you see, which the government has certainly used, but in other ways there are spontaneous, you know, citizen journalism bits that do give you insight into events that we wouldn't have otherwise. So both are true. Now, the other assumption is that the majority of people around the world have access to the internet. Is this correct? And are most of them, I know most people have cell phones if they don't have computers, so are they doing this on cell phones?
Well, a lot of them are, and remember that the proportion of so-called smartphones in the cell phone universe is only growing.
Right.
And, you know, if you think about sort of the history of information media, starting with the human voice, then moving through movable print to text, and then on to radio and television, and finally onto pure video on the internet. In historical terms, the age of video, which I think we have been in now for about 10 years, in historical terms, that's like 5 minutes after midnight. So that almost everything that we say about video now is only going to become more significant and more dominant over probably the next 50 years until the next media transformation takes place.
Well, dare I ask you what you think of the state of radio around the world now?
Well, you know, radio was the revolutionary instrument that made the 1960s a revolutionary decade because radio was cheap and therefore ubiquitous. And radio through the telephone talk show meant that citizens could participate in local, national, regional, and global debates that before they had been unable to access. And furthermore, again, just as video eliminates the language barrier, radio eliminated the literacy barrier, so that all over the third world, where there were huge percentages of the population that were intellectually isolated because they were illiterate, now if they had literally the $5 that it cost to buy a transistor radio, and if there were a telephone anywhere in their neighborhood, they could become active citizens, participating citizens. And I think we're seeing that kind of explosion of at least virtual participation through video.
You know, recently, Jeremy Scahill spoke at the Lensic. He was supported by Lannan. It was a fantastic presentation, but something really struck me. One, that his absolutely extraordinary reporting efforts were fully supported, or maybe not fully, but to a very large monetary amount by the Lannan Foundation. And I asked him afterwards also about safety precautions, and he said, everything I do has to be encrypted now. And so how does that allow people to become part of the process? I mean, we talk about video, we talk about radio, how it just allows more and more people in. And yet, to do real investigative journalism now, getting grant support and being able to encrypt all of your own information is not necessarily a given. Where do you see that kind of journalism coming from and going?
Well, on the one hand, the encryption issue, which is a very real and serious one, really only refers to specific kinds of national security investigative reporting. A lot of much more local and less globally strategic areas of investigative reporting still don't require necessarily that level of encryption. Although as hackers become more proficient, and as hacking becomes more conventional, there will have to be encryption countermeasures to protect sources as well as to protect proprietary information. So on the one hand, what is a big problem for Jeremy Scahill may not be a big problem for the KSF news department.
And yet funding always is, right?
Well, yeah, it's a world of problems, but it's also a world of reporting opportunities.
Right.
Now, the question again, in order to do global, long-form, in-depth investigative reporting, some kind of financial support is absolutely necessary, some kind of sponsorship, whether it be foundation or maybe entrepreneurial, or a combination of the two. This new proposed video news channel that Pierre Omidyar of eBay Billions, involving Jeremy Scahill, among others, is maybe an alternative model for this. But remember, a lot of what they're planning to put on the Internet or on mobile devices, on their apps, if you will, is not professional, long-form, in-depth reporting. A lot of it will be breaking news reporting of the sort, and here the sort of transformational event was the terrorist attack in Mumbai in 2008, where there were enough people with cell phones on or near the scene that they were actually reporting the story to the world via Twitter and Facebook and analogous websites before even CNN India or the Indian news channels, and India, by the way, has 8 full-time English language news channels, could get their camera crews and professionals to the scene. And by the time they got there, the story had already been defined by these amateur reporters. And ever
well, this
since
was similar in
time,
Cairo, right?
Pardon?
This was similar in Cairo, wasn't it?
Yeah, I was going to say, ever since that time, since 2008, almost every major event that occurs in public gets reported first by the informal sector, if you will, people with cell phones. And yes, Tahrir Square was a good example of that. Although I have to say there that the various Al Jazeera channels were already so plugged in to the revolution that their presence was early and really definitive.
Well, and speaking of Al Jazeera, I know that it's been more than 5 years since you left, but can you comment a little on why you left Al Jazeera, if you watch it now, and what you think of Al Jazeera English as a respectable news station here in America?
Well, of course, Al Jazeera English no longer is marketed to America. Al Jazeera America has replaced it, and it's a cable-only channel. It has disconnected from the live stream and disconnected largely except for a website that is text and a few video clips from the Internet. And poisonally being a cord cutter at the moment, I don't see Al Jazeera America frequently enough to comment intelligently on it, although from everything that I hear, they are doing what I expected them to do, which is to say real reporting from the scene. And its only bias is that it wants to be as accessible as possible to an American audience. When I left Al Jazeera English, a different channel with different programming, I felt that the upper management, which included no Americans, had a kind of bias against Americans, i.e. me, and that this often spilled over into their reporting, not so much that they would report in a distorted way, but that they would seek stories that would be embarrassing to or critical of America, and often recite them without any real-world context. They did a series on poverty in America as if poverty were unique to America. And they didn't bother to report out the details for the series. They made every series into a kind of iconic in the richest nation in the world, which, of course, even by 2007, 2008, we no longer were. But even in the richest nation in the world, there is poverty. Woo.
Right.
Woo.
Right.
Breaking news. We had several vigorous discussions about this, and at that time I was the senior anchor for all of their product that was being broadcast out of America, and I simply refused to run anything that I felt didn't meet my own personal journalistic standards. And so there was, as they call it, friction, and it was clear to me that it was time to go, and I did. And I left, and I attacked them for what I thought was this kind of parochial, reflexively anti-colonial view of America. But at the same time, I said that in terms of their coverage of the rest of the world and their coverage in general, they were probably even then the best news channel on the planet. And I think they probably are. And most of the people who have started news channels since then have said that Al Jazeera English is their role model and competition even more than CNN or BBC, and that was a new development in the competitive universe.
I'm speaking here with David Marish. He is formerly of ABC News, Nightline, and Al Jazeera. I want to ask you, a lot of people ask me, just as a journalist, where do you get your news?
Well, as I say, having cut the cord, I don't see the news channels except as they appear on the Internet. So the Internet has become my major source of news, that and, you know, my local hometown newspaper, which is the Albuquerque Journal.
Well, that's a good thumbs up for the Albuquerque Journal there. David Marish, we're going to have to go soon, but I hope I can have you back. I have so many more questions remaining that I want to talk to you about. I would hope to have you back and talk about more issues about media, video journalism, and what I've been calling the foxification of the news. So will you join us again on the Radio Cafe?
Oh, it would be my pleasure. But, you know, the foxification of the news may, in fact, be yesterday's news because Jeff Zucker, the head of CNN has said that he is going to completely revamp the channel and try and take a lot of the news out of it, by the way. And he sees as his competition, not MSNBC and Fox, I think because he has no hopes of beating either of them, but his competition, he says, is Discovery, A&E, History Channel, and National Geo Channel, to which I can only say in Yiddish, Oy vey es mir, woe is me.
On that note, we'll definitely be watching these events as they transpire. Thank you so much, David Marish, for joining us.